Hi everyone, my name is Andra Stanoyo and you're listening to the Healthy Debate Show here on UK Health Radio, the real feel-good radio. I was reading the other day an article in Harvard Health blog written by Beverly Melch that really drew my attention. She wrote, "The last time I had a mammogram, I got a big surprise, and it was a good one. A string quartet was playing just outside the doors of the breast imaging center, and my thoughts immediately shifted from what are they going to find on the mammogram to is that Schubert or Beethoven? And by the time my name was called, I had almost forgotten why I was there." This article really made me think about the healing power of music and about the power of shifting our negative thoughts and replacing them with positive tunes. Therefore, today I chose a special guest, Adriana Barton, the author of Wired for Music. She's a health journalist and former cellist that explores music as a source of resilience, health, and joy. And today she's here with us to discuss about her book that already has a great success around the world. Hi, Adriana. Welcome to the Healthy Debate Show.
Hello, Andra. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Absolutely. I was very, very excited about our call today. And that's because I'm such a huge fan of music. You know, music has been part of my life since I can remember, and probably music and dance. And I've always find ways to integrate music, even in my show, for example. So I'm very pleased to have you here. And I'm very pleased to hear about your great success with your book, Wired for Music. I know it was released just a couple of weeks ago, and already you have great success. So please tell us about, you know, your career. What made you decide to write Wired for Music?
Well, it's kind of a long story. I started out playing the cello when I was very young, 5 years old, and I was enrolled in a very strict music conservatory. And what I didn't understand, because I was so young, was that in exchange for free lessons, and by this I don't mean 1 hour a week, I mean cello lessons and theory and solfège, which is sight singing and orchestra, and many hours a week of instruction at a young age, that there was an expectation that I become a professional musician. And I was a dutiful child. And so I did as was expected of me, and practiced and made that my goal. Soul searching, as well as some injuries in my arms, and felt that maybe this path wasn't right for me. And I walked away from music when I was 22. And then I didn't play anything for several years. I had some sadness and a lot of blocks around music, in fact. And then I became a health journalist, and more I saw fascinating studies using neuroscientific tools to study the effects of music on the brain and on our bodies. And this was just staggering for me, because I had immersed myself in music for 17 years and had no idea exactly what it did for us as a species. And so the book became an exploration of these topics, melding together my own journey with music, because I did reclaim my relationship to music, melding that with the science that kept coming out.
I love how you use the word reclaim my relationship with music, because this is what I was thinking whilst you were talking. You know, when you're spending 17 years of your life being so diligent, so disciplined, and then you suddenly give it up. I imagine there was a feeling of loss, probably. I'm just assuming, Adrian. Of course, you can correct me. But then you managed to reintegrate this in your life. So I'm just curious about how you managed this loss, as much as you can share with us, of course. And how did you manage to make this bond?
It was very difficult, as you suspect, those first few years after leaving the cello, because not only was I leaving a career, I was leaving an identity. I really had never done anything else. I was known as Adriana who plays the cello, or Adriana the cellist. I really didn't know what else I was good for. I didn't have other interests developed. I didn't have sports that I did, or very many pastimes, because it really consumed my life. And so it was identity issues. It was a loss of meaning. It was also being separated from these vibrations and this beauty in sound that I was used to. So these were all difficult things. And for a time, I just became a music listener and got my music fix, I guess, that way. But eventually I started dabbling in different instruments, and I needed to try instruments that were entirely different from the classical world. Not that I criticize, I don't think there's anything wrong with classical music. I just had too many triggers and too much baggage around it. So I needed to explore other forms of music. And so I started listening to music from around the world and gradually learning percussion instruments and a little bit of ukulele and a Zimbabwean instrument called the imbira, and just sort of allowing myself to explore freely.
Do you think with time you managed to actually absorb music differently because of your life experiences? The reason why I'm asking this is because I almost have a similar story. I did professional ballroom dance for probably 15 years, and then suddenly I gave up, and I entered this world of psychology and coaching and mentoring, and for me it was a bit traumatic, but I didn't realize at that time, because for me it was just, you know, you have to grow up, you need to make a choice, you can't make a living out of dancing, just, you know, grow up and do a proper job. So I started doing a proper job, but my heart has always been, you know, on the dance floor. And I find it even hard now to make peace with that. So that thought, for example, I'm not watching shows that are with dance. So for me, it's quite painful. It's still painful because I've always wanted that, and I always thought I was good at it. So that's why I was just curious around, you know, the transition, and if you think that music is felt differently now due to your experiences, because I see myself looking at dance differently now as the years went by.
I think it has changed, and if I were to articulate it simply, I would say that music is no longer something I'm trying to master or trying to be good at. It's something that I do with other people. It has to feel good, and I leave musical situations that don't feel good or that feel too much like it's about improving or expertise. These things are kind of a turnoff for me now. At the same time, when you have a highly developed ear, it's difficult to participate in just a jam session at the beach. You kind of want to be around people who are a little bit knowledgeable or have some background. But I find that, so that's one part, is that having it be about connection with other people instead of about improvement or mastery or skill development is a major shift. And the other part is, I would say, in the music that I used to do, the classical music on the cello, I was so focused on every note and so focused on achieving a certain level of sound quality or pitch or whatever, that there wasn't as much letting yourself go as I often feel now, because the instruments I play are simpler and perhaps more rhythmically oriented. I can find myself slipping into a different mindset, or almost like a trancey, without sounding too esoteric, almost like a trance-like state that sounds, or it feels very enjoyable, and that time slips away, and I can let myself go a little more, I guess.
Yes, because it's not about discipline, it's about enjoying the moment and being in the moment. And these are two quite separate feelings, especially when you grow up in this very almost like formal way of looking at music, with very little probably input for, you know, having fun and really enjoying it.
Something relevant there I'd like to tell you, if you don't mind.
No, perfect.
One thing I learned through the research of this book is that some of the most powerful effects of music happen through its stimulating effects on our pleasure and reward center in the brain. And that is, you know, dopamine is involved, dopamine spikes when we listen to music. Other pleasure chemicals are also involved. But what I learned is that we also have a brain circuitry that some people call the punishment circuit. And that's formally known as the periventricular system. And that is a system that prepares us for fight, flight, or freeze. It pumps us with adrenaline and cortisol. And the purpose is to help us protect ourselves. And if we're learning music in a very strict, critical environment, it's going to activate the punishment circuitry. And what we also know is that that circuit actually short circuits or inhibits the pleasure reward circuitry. So it's going to be more difficult to associate making music with joy and pleasure if we're learning in that kind of environment for years.
This reminds me of a story about, I'm so bad with names, I can't remember, but there was a famous ballet dancer, a Russian ballet dancer that performed extraordinary for 20 years and then he just had enough and left everything behind. And I remember it was quite a big story on the news that he had the audacity to, you know, leave the company he was working for and just dance on the music that he enjoyed rather than, you know, classical music and the classical plays that he did for 20 years. So it was a bit of a revenge almost, or taking his life back.
It's impressive that he could do it. I mean, in my case, I wasn't burdened with fame and that level of expectation. It's one thing to do it until you're 22 and be on the cusp of a lifelong career, but it's quite another to be known in every household as a dancer of that caliber. So I think it took even more guts, whatever he did.
Well, absolutely. He outraged everyone. And then he had some tattoos on and that was just the end of it. He was the ultimate. Good for him. Yeah, but he was the ultimate rebel.
Well, life is too short to do things only for others' expectations.
It is indeed. And I was quite pleased to see the fact that he did have the courage to say, you know, it's enough, you know, it's enough. But it's interesting that usually the comments, the very mean and angry comments are coming from people who didn't experience this level of discipline. Because if they only knew how long it takes for you to become a professional cello player or a dancer or probably, and how much sacrifice, there's so much sacrifice. I remember when I was dancing, I didn't have weekends. I didn't have my own schedule. My life wasn't mine. It was just a schedule that I had to, you know, stick to. So exactly. Probably you experienced similar things, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I came across when I was researching the book, I had to go down memory lane because it really felt like somebody else's life. It felt so long ago and such a different. I've developed so much as a person since then. But I opened a box in the garage and I was quite sad to see, you know, notebooks filled with exactly how many minutes I practiced each day and what I practiced and rating my own practice sessions and, you know, a lot of things like that in that box.
So do you think, let me rephrase this. What lessons did you have from music? Did it taught you anything or how much?
Do you mean the music I did then?
Just music in general, you know, how did music contribute to your growth? What are some of the lessons you got from music?
Well, it's hard to say because I haven't lived anyone else's life, only my own. One thing that I get to at the end of my book is seeing that. So in the beginning of the book, I talk a lot about the ways that the training I had might have harmed me. I really struggled with perfectionism, so much so that I consulted a world expert in the psychology of perfectionism to get help because I felt that I was unable to express myself creatively in the way that I wanted. And I felt that I would get very hung up on details and anxious about things being just so. And I didn't like that side of my personality because my mother is a wildly creative artist. And for me, that was how one should be. And I couldn't seem to do it. And I do think that the rigid training I had encouraged me to be that way. So, you know, at the beginning of the book, I talk about some of the negative impacts of my experiences with music. But later in the book, I ask myself if some of that structure and order that I had through classical music helped me get through a pretty chaotic family life. There wasn't a lot of order at home, and there were some very difficult things going on at home. My brother was born with congenital heart problems, which made him ill for many years. And my father died when I was an infant. There were many things that were difficult. And perhaps the structure helped me get through it. Perhaps the music I was immersed in soothed me in ways that I didn't fully understand as a young child and as a teenager. And then certainly the pleasure side of music grew and grew as I learned to navigate music on my own terms.
One of the things I love most about your book is the fact that it tells a story. It's not just music. It's a great illustration about how music can be integrated in our lives, and it's about life experiences. What made you choose this type of format? How did you come up with the idea of integrating your personal experiences into this book?
Well, I'll start by saying that I think a lot of people who embark on a large creative project will agree that sometimes that project takes a life of its own and takes us to places we didn't anticipate. So the book, to be honest, started out, I was a journalist at the Globe and Mail covering health, and I was wanting something new in my life. And I applied for a graduate program in ethnomusicology, and I was offered a spot in the program. It was quite competitive, and I was offered a spot, and for some reason I turned it down. I had this thought for a thesis that I would compare traditional uses of music as medicine with the new neuroscience of music, and compare how the science might be validating some of these age-old uses of music. But then I turned the spot down. My child was young, and I was concerned about spending so much time at the university and missing his childhood writing a PhD thesis. So I didn't do it, but I was approached by a publisher saying, "Do I have any book ideas?" And we brainstormed a little bit, and then I told them about this interest that I have in music and health, and then mentioned my background as a cello, and he said, "That's the one." He his eyes twinkled, and he felt that was a book that I should write. Even then, though, I still thought, well, I'll be focusing on the science and the ethnomusicology and basically doing the research I would have done in a PhD situation. So I started out doing that and developed a proposal, and it didn't really work. It came off as too academic, and early readers kept saying, "Well, your story is so fascinating. More of you. Why aren't you? That's the part we want to read." And so after I delivered the first draft of the manuscript to the publisher, they said, "More of you." And, you know, I had to realize that this project was going to become what it needed to be, and I wanted to be responsive to what people saw. And the personal stories really help people relate, because music is not just about neurochemicals or brainwaves. You know, those parts are interesting, but only if they intersect and relate somehow to things we sense and feel in our lives. And that's a part of the book that people keep telling me they love, the blend of science and story.
And I think this is a great way of presenting yourself, Adriana, isn't it? Because it would have been such a loss just to focus on the technical side of music and not integrate your story. I think the heart of the book are actually these experiences that you so willingly shared with the whole world. And as I was going through your book, I saw that you made a lot of references to nature, to your traveling experiences. What's the connection between music and traveling and nature?
Well, for me, traveling is one way to see how other societies use and connect to music. In Western Europe, we have a particular history with music that I didn't fully understand until I researched the book. I won't give it away, but it helps explain why a lot of people feel some sort of alienation from music making. And so by traveling, I was able to experience music in cultures that didn't necessarily have that history or that alienation in the same way. That's one answer. Another is that if you think about it, we are animals, we are an old species, and we evolved with the sounds of nature all around us, birds and rivers streaming and wind and other animals making sounds. And so, without being too corny, I'll say that our music making ability is, we've been making music as a species for literally millennia, so we forget that it's not a recent development. Music is very old in our species, and I go into that in chapter two, where music might have come from. So it bubbled out of our minds, it bubbled out of the development of the human brain, it bubbled out of the earth, and we share some capacities for music that you find in other animals. Our capacities for music seem to be even more sharp and exquisite, but other animals do show signs of musicality. It is not uniquely a human trait.
Is there a particular country that really made you think differently about music, or something that stuck with you for good?
Well, I would say almost everywhere I've been, I've seen music making that impressed me and that filled me with wonder and joy. And I've had the fortune to travel to India. I've gone to Syria and Jordan and all across Europe and Brazil and Africa, Zimbabwe, Cuba. All of these places have very rich musical traditions. And I would say, too, that watching people engage with music in really informal ways, chiming in with the chorus of a song or picking up a triangle. You see that in Brazil, people will pick up a tambourine or a triangle, and they don't consider themselves musicians necessarily, but at a party, they'll play whatever's lying around or sing or dance very freely. And it's wonderful to see this.
Adriana, after a few minutes of commercial break, I would like us to look into how music can contribute to mental health, how it can improve our day-to-day life. And I also have some questions related to your book. So stay tuned. We'll be back in a few minutes with Adriana Barton.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltz know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltz, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltz. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
And we're back with Adriana Barton, the author of Wired for Music. Adriana, before our break, we were discussing about your experiences, your traveling, and how music is connected with all of these. But as I was going through your book, I found a specific paragraph that really drew my attention, and I wanted to bring it today just to hear your thoughts. It starts with, early psychiatrists had an intuitive grasp of music mood-enhancing effects. In the mid-19th century, specialists in Baden, Germany, believed individuals with mental illness healed best in pastoral setting with plenty of music. This made me really want to bring this up because in one of our phone calls before we sit down for the show, I was telling you that I worked as a special needs teacher for quite a bit of time, and at that time there was a specific setting that we had to have in the classroom, and music wasn't allowed. But as I always loved to break the rules, I introduced classical music in the background, and it was specific for different mental health issues like anxiety, depression, and I immediately almost sense that the children were feeling more relaxed. They started to learn better. They started to be more active in the classroom in the best possible way. So what's the connection between mental health and music, and what made you decide to investigate this space?
The idea of music having effects on our mood is such a relatable concept for most people. Most of us have had times when music just lifted us up or soothed us. And so it would be odd to write a book about music and health without including a large chapter on the effects of music on our moods. I was very fortunate to interview Dr. Robert Satori at McGill University, whose team was the first to discover demonstrate without any doubt that music stimulates dopamine in the brain, and dopamine is is intimately related to the pleasure and reward circuitry in the brain that we talked about earlier, among other functions. The history of using music as a modality for mood goes way back. There's even a reference in the Bible, and certainly the Greeks believed that music had an effect on our moods. And then you see this in the Islamic world. While Europe was in the Dark Ages, these Islamic physicians spoke about music as a healing modality for mental health issues. And even if you continue through the centuries, that came back to Europe. As you mentioned, certainly physicians and psychiatrists, the early psychiatrists in the 19th century, started to attune to the effects of music. What changed is we began to have neuroscience tools to measure music in the brain. And certainly the pleasure reward circuitry is one of the most important ways that music affects our moods, but also it changes our heart rate and breathing and cortisol levels, which is stress, depending on the tempo that we're listening to. So if we listen to slow paced music, about 60 to 80 beats per minute, the pace of a resting heart, our heart rate will actually slow down to match the music, and our breathing will slow down and we'll start to calm down. So that's super important to know. If you want to chill out after the end of a stressful day, you want to choose slow-paced music. And the neat thing is, you can find playlists online organized by beats per minute. So you can find a slow-paced playlist on Spotify or YouTube or other places and pick out the songs that you like best, because that's the other thing to know. You're going to have the strongest effect from the music that you love the most, because that's going to have the strongest effect on your pleasure reward circuitry. And you might think, oh, well, that's just pleasure. But in fact, when you stimulate that circuitry, there are also downstream effects on the body's analgesic system, which is the body's natural pain-killing system. It's all connected in that way. And so that's one thing. We can look at the brain, look at brain chemicals and things like that. But there has also been a lot of research looking at stress and depression and anxiety in real world situations, not just neuroscience labs. And so, for example, they studied music as a treatment for preoperative anxiety. That's people about to go through surgery. And it's very important to treat preoperative anxiety, because people who are too anxious before surgery tend to have more pain after the surgery and more a longer recovery time. And so in various studies, music was tested head-to-head with Valium and other anti-anxiety medications, and found to be of similar benefit for acute anxiety in surgery wards, which is pretty striking if you think about it. Now, I'm a journalist, so for me, one study isn't enough to convince me, but in fact, music for preoperative anxiety has been studied in quite a few randomized controlled trials, and then vetted by the Cochrane Organization, which is one of the global leaders in evidence-based medicine. So for me, that's impressive. And you see similar results in large reviews of music for depression, music for stress.
This makes me think about the amount of artists that the world has produced that said on numerous occasions that music saved them. And you see them, recovering from depression and bringing the best music to the table, or making the best films, you know, because of this creative mind. And I know that last night you went to an Elton John concert. How was it, Adriana? Is he still standing?
It was absolutely fabulous. I live in Vancouver, and he hasn't come all that often in his career. He was 75, and he just brought down the house. They were, I can't even say how many people that stadium holds. It was in the tens of thousands. And what I saw last night filled me with wonder and delight, because, as you know, the world has been going through a very tough time, and there's increasing division and increasing differences of opinion. And what I saw was a crowd of people of all stripes, all ages, coming together and remembering what they share in common, and remembering that the world isn't just dark. There is joy, there is celebration, there is meaning, there is triumph. And I could feel that everywhere around me, and it was undeniable. And music has been doing this for our species for, again, centuries, millennia. If you read the book, you'll see that there are specific properties in music that bind us to each other as a species. And it probably had that function very early on in our evolution. I'll give you an example. In the Schwabian Alps of Germany, archaeologists found flutes that are 44,000 years old, made out of mammoth bone and vulture wing, the bone of a vulture. And these flutes, they theorize, weren't just for entertainment. They weren't just playthings, because their position was right amongst the cooking tools and things that would be used in everyday life. And the theory is that music acted as a kind of social glue that made it not only bearable but enjoyable for early bands of humans to come together and huddle in ice age caves and wait out the weather and the attacks from wild animals, etc. So this is a very old activity that we have that draws us together.
Adriana, I would like us to discuss after the short break about teaching music and about the use of music in our day-to-day lives. So let's come back after a few minutes with Adriana Barton, the author of Wired for Music.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
And we're back with Adriana. We're discussing the benefits of music and how great music is in our day-to-day lives. Adriana, I have a curiosity. You mentioned in your book your son.
Yes.
And because I'm a teacher at core, I need to go back to the discipline of teaching. Did you use music to teach him, to prepare him for life? Was music part of his upbringing in any way?
It was. I wish I could redo it, if I could be honest with you. And I'll tell you, as a researcher and journalist, I was seeing studies that really impressed me that if a child had intensive music training before the age of 7 to 9 years old, it actually alters the brain for life. And what it does is it thickens the corpus callosum, which is a band of fibers in between the two brain hemispheres, the two sides of the brain, that helps signals travel faster from one side to the other. And it also, music training increases density in auditory, motor, and sensory areas of the brain. And I thought, oh, fabulous, I have to enroll my son so that he gets these brain benefits. Unfortunately, for one thing, I didn't know at the time that those brain changes may or may not have benefits beyond music. They might, but it's not looking like music makes kids smarter or gives them increased superpowers in other areas. That's one thing. But another, I chose a group lesson of piano training, and it was one that was supposed to integrate some games. I thought, oh, I want to do this better than I had myself. But nonetheless, the old patterns came out in me that I was concerned about my child keeping up. And I kind of, have you done your practicing? And I'd sit beside him and say, do it again. And I blew it, basically. So we had him in those lessons for a couple of years. And then I tried to take his cues and switch teachers. But by that time, I think I had already gone the wrong direction with my son. And he actually has a wonderful ear and enjoys singing in the shower. And I then backed off entirely. And one thing that gave me a lot of joy is that in his school, in grade 6 or 7, I guess he was, maybe 12, they had this wonderful music program where they were teaching children taiko drums, which are Japanese drums that are very physical, and then also exposing them to the African marimba and having the children start to learn about the parallels between different types of rhythmic instruments. And he really enjoyed that. And I was lucky that I hadn't turned him off music entirely. I was smart enough to watch the signs and take him out of it and take the pressure off. But I'm hoping that he will have a chance to continue his own musical journey in his own way as time goes on.
You know, you said that you were going back to into your own habits. I think it's fantastic that you recognize that and you stop and you chose a different path and you reshaped your behavior. What's happening quite often is that parents are very, you know, intense about their children performing and being in a particular pattern and fitting into specific social norms. And they kind of don't observe their children and forget about the human component of whatever activity they're doing. So I think it's great, you know, at least you had a go. And I truly think that, you know, it gave him an opportunity to explore, and then maybe later on he will have the appetite to, you know, maybe follow a similar path, or why not? At least it's good to know what you like and what you don't like equally in life, isn't it?
It is. I'll say before he dropped the piano altogether, we even tried, and we found him a teacher who's this motorcycle riding hipster guy who actually did house calls. So he came to our house and he allowed my son to choose his own music. And my son chose a song by a British band called Baggy Trousers. So he learned that for a while. So we did try different, you know, we didn't give up right away. We tried to relax it. But I think, as I said, I think the die had already been cast a bit. So we backed off altogether after that.
Well, I'm sure he will make his own choices when he grows up. So, just be positive. I think it was a good experience, Adrienne. Overall, I think you were successful. Can we train our brain to like music, considering all these great benefits that we discussed today?
I don't think we have to. What is wonderful about music is that the inability to enjoy music is so incredibly rare that it's considered a neurological condition. I mean, only something like 2 to 4% of people find no pleasure in music. So that's what's wonderful about our innate wiring for music. We don't have to work at liking it.
it kind of comes natural, isn't it? If you there's so much research that shows, you know, the benefits for newborns, isn't it? You know, the drums and the sounds that the mom is listening while she's pregnant and how it influences the fetus. So I think you're right. I was just testing you, Adriana, to see what you're saying, but you did fantastic.
Well, I will say that
please,
sorry, if you allow me to sure. Say one thing, that it is a myth that playing Mozart to children in while they're in the womb makes them smarter, that this is not true. What is true, though, is that newborns remember music they heard in the womb. And that's been demonstrated with some really interesting experiments. So if you play, a band like Oasis, or a band like Tragically Hip, or the Beatles, or if you play Beethoven, that a child will remember that song 6 weeks later after they're born.
To be fair, I was thinking more, the psychologist in me was thinking more about the emotional connection, you know, and yes, you are right. You know, how newborns will remember music rather than making children intelligent. I think there's such a run for, you know, I want to have the smartest child in the school. I want to have I'm so not for that. I think we have to have children that are emotionally intelligent, that are able to, you know, integrate music and dance and arts in their lives and become creative individuals and develop their creative thinking rather than being I don't know, the smartest. That's not something that I would go for. Adrian, please.
I agree, and I would also say that most likely a fetus will absorb the emotions that a mother, a parent is having as they listen to music. And so if a pregnant person is listening to music they deeply enjoy, then that will carry over into the fetal environment.
Adriana, where can we buy your book, and do you have any social media links that you would like to share with us today? Because we're getting close to the end of it, if you can imagine. It just went in a second, isn't it?
My book can be purchased anywhere where books are sold. So the large online outfits that everybody knows, as well as independent bookstores. It is distributed in the UK. I've already heard from readers that have written to me from the UK telling me that they purchased their copies. I know also that people are searching me up online. I have a website, adrianabarton.com. I'm on Twitter, also at Adriana Barton. I'm on Facebook, and I'm on Instagram at @AdrianaBarton_author. So you can follow me on any of those platforms, and certainly the book is easy to find if you search online. There is also an audiobook, and this is a funny story. I didn't know, because I'd never written a book before, that I had to audition to narrate my audiobook. And so I did. Because it was professionally produced, and so I had to produce a clip of my narration, and luckily they approved it. And so I was in the studio in June recording the audiobook.
Adriana, thank you so much for your time. I do recommend everyone that's listening to go and search online for Adriana's book. As I said a couple of times in the show, this is not just a book about music. Adriana has done intense research, and if you are purchasing her book, you will see that she has approximately 60 pages of references to research and case studies, which, you know, for me, as someone that likes to read good quality books and based on research, I would say it's a fantastic book. So definitely go look up for the book online and just enjoy and blend music into your day-to-day lives. Thank you so much, Adriana, and best of luck. I know you're very busy with the book now, so I hope everything goes perfectly, exactly as you plan.
Thank you, Andra. I appreciate your enthusiasm, and your questions are excellent, and it's been a complete delight to talk to you today.
Thank you. I was inspired by a chapter in your book, and I chose for the end of the show a great 70s hit played by the American music group The Whispers. And I would like us to listen now to And the Beat Goes On. And until next time, may we hear only good things. Just like my love, the love.
this is